Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Stavropoulos, and you're listening to Reasonable and Necessary, the NDIS podcast series brought to you by the Summer Foundation. Joining me today is the Minister for the NDIS, Minister Bill Shorten. I spoke with him before the election when he committed to rebuild trust in the scheme. Almost 3 months later, and he is now in charge. But what has he learned since taking over? And what is he going to do to address the issues facing NDIS participants today? Let's find out. Hey, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be back on your show. Thank you for having me back.
You're the minister now. How does it feel?
It feels great. It feels like the chance to help rebuild trust in the scheme, a chance to help people. It's why I went into politics, for the purpose of helping people empower their own lives. So I feel very lucky, very privileged.
You're almost 3 months into it, Bill. Mm-hmm. Is it what you expected?
Yes and no. I've encountered more problems at the agency than I was expecting, I'll be honest. I think that, and when I say that, I'm not talking about the thousands of APS staff, but I am surprised at the slow pace of change. There's been an election, new government, new minister, and I really want us to get moving on problems in the scheme and making it a better experience for more people.
What are your priorities, Bill?
Well, the first one, and it remains a constant priority, is to make sure that we're keeping people on the scheme and people with disability generally COVID safe. And listen, we're getting a fair bit of cooperation on that, so that's crucial because COVID's a very real threat and risk to people with reduced immunities. So I'm very conscious of our obligation to do everything we can in our power to help keep people safe. A couple of other my early priorities are to unblock hospitals, the exit block where people who are eligible for NDIS are stuck languishing in hospitals for months and months. And also I want to reduce the amount of disputation between participants in the agency triggering AAT actions. I want to reduce the legacy cases. On both these matters, I thought I could make more speedy progress, and so that's really right at the front of my brain at the moment.
Fantastic. Well, so we're going to get to talk about all of those things in a bit of depth. So let's start with the issue of people with disabilities who are stuck in hospitals. We know that before the election, when you and I spoke, you said you needed to look under the proverbial bonnet. So tell me, what did you find under the bonnet?
Well, I've been visiting hospitals, talking to people with disability, talking to clinicians and rehab experts. I'm finding that there's good reasons and bad reasons why people are stuck in hospitals long when they're eligible for NDIS support. I get that there's, in some parts of Australia, insufficient housing options, and I shouldn't call it a good reason, it's not. I can understand that. But what is a bad reason by any stretch of the imagination is slow decision-making processes within the agency. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. There's too much what I call linear decision-making where, we want reports and reports to make sure that someone's eligible. Then we take time for someone to go and meet them, and then everything seems to be one decision at a time, whereas I know that for other schemes, hospitals are able to support people re-enter the community much more speedily, but it just all seems to go into slow motion when it comes to some of the people in hospitals and the agency. So I've got to really prioritise that.
It's interesting because I was looking at some data and there are over 1,000 brand new SDA vacancies that are sitting empty. So it's not like there's not the places for people to know, right?
Yeah, I think maybe in parts of regional Australia or Tasmania, there is a bona fide shortage. But as a general rule, what you said is right, George. And like it's slow decision making.
So we need to get the decision making fast tracked. Is that what you're saying?
This is the analogy I'd use. Imagine if you had to travel five railway stations. Normally what you do is you get on the train at railway station A, and by the time that train takes you through to railway station E, you know, the fifth one. But what I feel sometimes happening with the agency and decision-making is, imagine if you could only get the train from A to B, then you've got to hop off, and then you've got to wait for a new train to take you from B to C, then you've got to hop off, then you've got to wait for the new train to take you from C to D, and then you've got to hop off, then you've got to wait for a train to take you from D to E. It's not a seamless process. We're not doing things concurrently. And there's enough knowledge. The other thing I want to do is I think the agency can afford to give delegated discretion to skilled planners who then embed themselves in the hospital process. So they get to know the rehab people and the community care people. I just, you know, sometimes you're better off letting the frontline people have some frontline powers.
Yes, I completely agree with that. One other thing on this issue is that I've seen reports about interim accommodation options that are being set up to move people out of hospital, and some of those look quite inappropriate. So one of them was an aged care facility.
I support the idea of transitional accommodation, but not inappropriate transitional accommodation. There's a point, though, I would make. While we wait for the forever home for someone who's in hospital, where there's good alternatives, that's actually safer than keeping someone in a hospital. So you're right. It's got to be that the transitional accommodation's got to be appropriate. But, you know, we do have a rental market in Australia. We can find alternative accommodation. But just waiting for the perfect of a forever home can actually jeopardise the health and safety of someone, a participant who's eligible to leave hospital.
I agree, Bill. I think that we need to look at these alternative interim.
We need to look at an SBA investment class, accommodation class for interim accommodation, which is focused on quality interim care.
Yeah, as long as we don't forget about people in those houses.
The problem right now is that people are in hospitals and they are being treated as put in the too hard basket or the too slow basket.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about a related issue, and that's young people in residential aged care.
Yeah.
We know that previous government made some commitments around this. Are you committed to achieving the targets set by the previous government?
Well, we wanted to keep them, but I don't think the previous government was keeping them. So I've been talking with my colleague Annika Wells, who's the aged care minister. I think basically people don't want me always talk about the previous government, but they are a fact of life. They did exist. But they made up targets and then forgot about them. Everything was just getting beyond the next election. So I'm meeting with aged care officials and I'm not satisfied at the progress that we're making. How quickly we can remedy it, I don't know, but I think a bit like hospital discharge, we've just got to get smarter about it and treat it as a priority, and not just a general statement or a feel-good statement in a press release. I'm going to find people in the system who are accountable for actually helping people out of inappropriate accommodation to appropriate accommodation.
Absolutely. You're the minister now. Are you still committed to those commitments? So we've got the commitment that by 2022, I'm assuming that's the end of the year, there'll be no people with disabilities who are under 65 going into aged care. Is that something that you're committed to?
Absolutely. Nothing's changed. What I don't know is how much the previous government hasn't done. So we're trying to get to the bottom of that. But the goal is the right goal. The outcome is the right outcome. But I just, this previous government sort of left us with a lot of ticking time bombs, in my opinion.
there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you're committed to the those commitments.
Yeah.
Before the election, we talked a lot about the AAT and the money that was wasted on lawyers. And I'm interested in what's happened since you've come in around that. Have you put into place any ways of...
I've held several meetings with civil society and with the agency to say I want the legacy list reduced. It's been reduced by about 200 cases, but I'm not satisfied even in the last 6 or 7 weeks that that's fast enough. The agency assured me that they're doing everything they can. I think it needs new thinking. So I've asked the agency to look at some different options to just business as usual and the way they're handling it so far. That is still a work in progress, George. I have a very firm view, but I've just got to get the agency moving in the same direction.
I remember when we spoke, you talked about one of the solutions here is to get the planning right at the start.
We're going to do an appropriate, the 10-year review of the scheme. We'll bring it forward to this year. We'll have more to say about that in coming weeks. But one way to stop the fire hose of cases spraying to the AAT is to make the initial planning decisions better. The next way is making sure that if you do disagree, there's an internal conciliation process in which you have confidence that you don't need a lawyer and you're not going to get shafted. So there's three aspects of what I'm talking to the agency about. One, I want to blitz the waiting list of cases. Two, I want to have an alternative dispute resolution process, which is lawyer-free. It doesn't mean anyone loses their legal rights, but this is lawyer-free because most participants can't afford lawyers against the agency. It means so I don't want the agency having lawyers either. In this alternative dispute process, I've said to the agency what I want to see is that the agency puts its reasons in writing, because how can you argue with an agency decision if you don't know the reasons for it? But the third leg of reform, and it's the most important, is get the planning right to begin with.
Absolutely. One really simple thing that I know the disability community has been asking for a very long time, and that's to be able to see a draft of their plan after their planning conversation. Yeah. That's still not happening. Why is that, Bill?
Because it's stupid. Of course it should happen.
So you don't make it happen?
I think planners should meet with the people they're designing the plans for.
Yes.
And I think they should send a draft to the participant and the participant's support network just to make sure that each has heard the other. I think these are very basic points. I'm confident we will get to that system.
I hope we do. I really think it's...
Otherwise... Yes, I'm confident we'll get there. I can't tell you which day we will get there, but listen, there's a lot to fix up from the previous government, but there's no doubt in my mind that how can you make a plan for someone without meeting them or talking to them, at least Zooming them?
Bill, I want to talk now about COVID. You did mention that it's one of your priority areas. We know that a lot of people with disabilities and people with underlying medical conditions are entering their third year of isolation while the rest of the country's gone back to business as usual. I'm really interested in how you see your government supporting people with disabilities and the workforce, because the workforce is key here. What are you going to be doing to support us?
Meetings between the department, the agency, and people with disability and their representatives about these questions. We've also done a sort of a mock exercise. We call it a red team, where we get a whole lot of experts in and we test them. We test the system with all the potential problems that could pop up. And what that work's showing is that we've got to make sure that PPE and RATs are getting out to people. Just got to keep supplying that material to people. The other thing is we've got to have a good push in terms of boosters, getting people boosted, because the rates are slower than they should be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that we We need to really look at masks and making sure that people can access N95 masks, and also that the workforce understands what kind of protections are going to keep people safe.
Well, there's no doubt that the disability workforce bore a lot of the brunt of the last two COVID outbreaks, where too often workers in their own time would have to go and get vaccinated. Workers would have to stay home and not go to work, so they didn't put their people they're working with at risk. That's why it's good that Labor reintroduced the pandemic leave provision for the workforce, so that people don't have a choice between isolating and starving.
Yes, it's very important. On the issue of workforce, it's so important. So I just think we can't talk about workforce enough. I think that the NDIS is only going to deliver the promise of good support if we have a strong and diverse and reliable workforce.
Yeah.
I know that you're also passionate about workforce, Bill. What are your plans around the disability workforce?
Next week, actually, in Canberra, I'm hosting a forum which is going to talk a lot about NDIS workforce. I'll have participants, DROs, disability rights organisations, service providers, unions, the agency experts, to talk about how we can best fill the gaps for the workforce needs of the future. And one thing I'm very keen to look at is how we provide career paths and vocational training for people with disability and carers to work more generally in the sector.
Excellent. Looking forward to that, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to turn to the price guide. We know that there were indexation, and that was to meet the changes under the award. But there are a couple of things that people are talking about that they're not happy about. The first one is that change to requiring 7 days' notice for cancellations. And I'm really interested in how, you know, in the regular world, the non-NDIS world, you know, 24 hours is sufficient. Why are we requiring disabled people to give 7 days' notice?
Well, sometimes you're not going to be able to. I realise that. But in the award, it's sensible to provide 7 days' notice. So I get that in the real world, life intrudes, so you can't plan everything 7 days in advance. But I think that where we can, we should try and also do best practice.
Interesting. I do know that, for example, therapists, OTs, if you cancel with them, they can spend that time getting someone else in to fill that spot. There's a waiting list. We also know that they can complete reports, but we're paying them $200 an hour to not do anything.
Yeah, well, I understand your point. I'll take it on board.
Thanks, Bill. The other issue that was in the price guide related to level 3 high-intensity category, and this is applied to people with high and complex needs. Now, in the new guide, that was removed. So there was less incentive for providers to take on people with complex needs. What are your views on this?
I think you make a good point. I can see that I don't want people overcharging when they don't need to overcharge. And I get worried sometimes that some service providers always charge the top dollar. Having said that, and you're not the first person in recent times to raise this issue, that by not having separate categories, you create economic incentive to look after some people and not others. So, I'm taking that on board. I think I can see what you're saying there. So I'm not sure that it's the answer's completely settled. I think that you've got a point with people's complex needs.
Thanks, Bill. I hope you can look into that.
Yeah.
One of my favourite topics, people with disabilities in leadership roles.
Mm.
Before the election, you made commitments around putting people with disabilities in these roles, which is fantastic and important. How's that going, Bill? And why haven't you called me? Have you lost my phone number?
You're hard to lose, George. We'll be making a package of announcements around CEO, chair, board. Some of the processes are finished around the CEO, but I'm hopeful that ideally in September, or definitely before the end of September, there'll be announcements about some leadership positions, and people with disability will be strongly represented in new appointments.
Fantastic.
I am conscious of that. This forum we're holding next week, nearly 50% of the participants are people with disabilities. So where I can directly influence things, I'm trying to practice what I preach. Right down to even staff in my office, I encourage my colleagues to talk about how we can do more leadership development.
Yeah, it's good. And I think that the NDIS, which is, for people with disabilities, should be informed by our experiences.
All right. That's my worldview. I know when I was leader of the Labor Party, I helped lead the debate in the Labor Party in 2015 that half of our candidates for Parliament should be women, and now that is what we've achieved. I understand, and I think one of the remaining frontiers is how we boost the leadership roles of people with disability. I'm not going to say every position will always be resolved to everyone's satisfaction, but over time I've got no doubt that where I can, I'm going to influence greater profile and role for people with disability to be in charge of decision making, not just for people with disability, but for everyone.
There's an example of this that was brought to my attention yesterday, and that was the issue of the Joint Standing Committee and the NDIS, and we understand that Senator Jordan Steelejohn, who is a disabled person and a very strong disability spokesperson, was overlooked for a leadership role on that committee.
I don't think he was overlooked. The government of the day normally provides the chairperson on these standing committees, and the opposition of the day normally provides the deputy. Jordan is in the Greens Party, of which there's only one person on that committee. So that's been the parliamentary convention. I'd go back to saying something I think I said earlier in answer to you. I'm not saying that every position each time will be resolved to everyone's satisfaction, but over time, I've got no doubt under this government, we're going to see a lot more people with disability in leadership positions. And as for Jordan, I meet with him directly. I take him very seriously, so we talk regularly.
There are similar concerns around the Disability Law Commission. The current commissioner does not have a disability, and he has a lot of power around the recommendations. I understand that his powers are quite high to a point where other commissioners don't necessarily get a say. Is this something that you're going to address?
I'm not going to start criticising the Royal Commission, George. I haven't necessarily heard what you just put to me. I think the Royal Commission is important. I think it's doing a power of work. I'd be surprised if other commission, and I don't really want to get into the specific of what you said, but just a general point, I'd say I'd be surprised if the other commissioners aren't making their views felt.
I'm referring to the letters patent.
What will judge the success or otherwise of the Royal Commission will be its recommendations. I think it's getting a lot better as it goes along about providing people with disability a direct voice. So I'm prepared to wait to see what's happening and what they recommend. But I think it's proven to be more positive than negative, absolutely. So I'm a bit of a supporter of the Royal Commission and the work it's doing.
I think it's very important, and I'm thinking more around that issue of leadership roles and disabled people.
And that was done by the previous government. Let's just watch this space and how I go with things that I can directly influence. And I think you'll find over time that we will start cementing a role for people with disability visibly in decision-making in this country, which is what we need to do.
Yeah, let's do that. So the final topic is the NDIS review that you mentioned earlier. Can you give us a bit of a taste of what to expect there?
This was a review which was originally scheduled for next year, the 10-year anniversary of the NDIS to be done by the Productivity Commission. Labor took a policy to the last election to have a focus on a range of aspects of the NDIS and bring forward this review. So we'll be announcing more on that pretty soon, to be honest. There'll be a steering committee. There'll be people with disability involved in the steering committee. There'll be a secretariat. It's not about cost cutting and in terms of a razor gang or reinventing the Liberal independent assessments. It's about basically pulling together all the work that's been done about suggesting informing it. It's about co-design of people with disability. How do we learn the lessons of the last 9 years and make the next 10 years of the NDIS better and brighter? Well, we already know a fair bit of what needs to be done, I think. And I think this review will help pull together a lot of the threads. It's not a forever review. I want to see its work and results coming to fruition by the budget of next year, so that we can start making sure the NDIS is more responsive than it is.
The terms of reference? And
yeah, that's happening. Some of the terms of reference are taken from the bilateral agreement with the state, so they're already set in stone. And the other issues that we want to look at in the review, we put to the Australian people before the last election. But the actual review will be done a lot with people with disability. I can guarantee that.
Bill, it's been a very interesting discussion. What final words would you like to share with people listening across the country?
We've got a lot to do, and I feel an obligation not to waste a second of a minute of an hour of a day. And I just want to start fixing up the pain. The scheme's about empowering people, not causing pain at the moment. I still think it's causing more pain than it should, so let's get that right.
Bill, I think there's a lot of excitement and positivity in the community about your role as our minister. You were the man who effectively advocated for this at the highest level. And we're very grateful for that, and we look forward to seeing the good work that you're going to do as minister.
It's a collective effort. It's a collective effort, and people with disability be at the centre of how we do it, what we do, why we do it.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for joining us on the show, and I'll see you very soon.
Yeah, look forward to catching up soon, George. Thank you, and thanks for what you do to help provide reliable, honest, accountable information to people.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Reasonable and Necessary, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. To be notified of future episodes, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.